I am Joanne Holt, and I'm from the University of Maryland. I'm a professor of health, physical education, recreation. My specialty is philosophy of sport, history of sport, and my research area, for those of you that haven't been around won't guess it, but the rest of you will know that it's women in sport is my first love in research, and my second is intercollegiate athletics for men and for women. So sprinkled around in our discussions, I have to bring out my nitty-gritty kinds of facts that I have so that you know I have some facts, and then you can play sport pursuit with them sometime or other. Although rarely do I find any of my great gems in the sport, but we try. My title I change just slightly. Sport builds character, or sport builds characters. And I'm not going to answer that for you. Each of you can answer that. But what I want to do is to talk a little bit about why we think it builds character, where in the world we got such an idea, and the net results of what has happened because of sport. All of the t-shirts that you see around the room I use in my philosophy of sport class, or in what I call my kid education class, which is a class for coaches to be, potential coaches, which may include wives and husbands and mothers and fathers, as an extension course that can be taken to try to deal in coaching. And so one of my other great loves is to look at youth, young children, and to see what is it we're doing to them or for them. And sometimes it seems to be to them rather than for them. Or, more to the point, sometimes it's for us instead of for the kids. And so what I have tried to do tonight is to combine really two of my lectures. One is on the price of glory, kids in an adult world of athletics, and fitness for adults. And we're going to ramble that on into one. If I seem to be going either too fast or there's something that you want to know that I just sort of touch on, you can either ask about it during the week or look at or listen to the other two tapes, which give the whole story as the group thought last week, at least. Since a lot of this, I really prefer to have discussions in your own experience and kinds of problems that you see in the world. I definitely believe that we can build character, but it is not innate in the sport itself. It is not natural in athletics, particularly, that we build character. I think we certainly do build characters. And I think each of you can have a favorite hero that didn't always end up as the model, male or female, that you're trying to follow. I'm doing a little research on women Olympians as role models, mentors, and leaders. And if there's anything I have found out about the female is that most of them were characters. And maybe they had to be characters between 1920 and 1936, particularly. If any of you listened to Eleanor Holm, who was a swimmer in the 1932 Olympics, was going to be a swimmer in the 36 Olympics, and she decided that she needed a touch of wine along with the rest of the men that were on the boat going to the Olympics in 1936. And our great president of the United States Olympic Committee said, no, no, you cannot swim if you drink. And so she was out. And in from that time on, she really had been sort of a character within our society. It also, of course, is a story of discrimination. Others of you at least have heard of Babe Didrikson, and she definitely was a character, and she definitely used sport as best she could, and probably followed what I would call the pro model. On the other hand, we can look at some of our present female athletes and male athletes, and we look at building character instead of characters. But I think that it is not by nature that sport builds character. As a matter of fact, we invented it ourselves. Particularly Americans invented the concept that it builds character when the men, particularly men around 1830 on, decided that they really wanted to sport and that they really wanted to compete in athletics. Now, how can good Christian young men do that? How can we use some way within the moral fibers of our society to permit it? What did we do?
Justified it.
We justified it. And we have something called muscular Christianity. And muscular Christianity, doesn't that sound wonderful? Muscular Christianity. And that meant you didn't just have to do calisthenics, you didn't just have to do exercises, but you could move into the sport world. And so that's really what we started to do someplace around 1850. And in fact, for our little trivia, intercollegiate athletics started in 1852. When there was a competitive rowing match between two of the greatest, staunchest colleges in our country. What is our first?
Harvard
and Yale. And furthermore, guess who sponsored it?
Washington.
Railroads. What do we have? Commercialized athletics and intercollegiate athletics. It is little wonder. Baseball itself, the sport of sports, the American sport, starts in 1845 with the Knickerbockers, elite sport. Forever after, we have the problem of social mobility, and does sport lead to social mobility? We have sports for the elite, which are what to this day?
Tennis, polo, golf,
yachting, and the middle class is continuously trying to be socially mobile up through sport. So one of the things we're constantly in is what sports ought we to do? As we moved into women in sport, what sports was sex appropriate for them? Tennis. Golf,
volleyball.
Men didn't play it in our country except those muscular Christians who were in the YMCA. And so that was perfectly all right with the men if the women played volleyball. And so we begin to see how our society really zeroes in on sport and individuals in the same sort of way. And so our national pastime of baseball starts very early, and we make it our own American sport. And by the 1890s, we can play in the World Series, and the poor Cubs can win twice. They can win again, by the way, what is it, 1945. And Stan Hack, my favorite third baseman, and a little bit of Pee Wee Reese, and obviously I'm from the Chicago area. And so in our whole discussion, you need to realize I am not anti-competition. But I think what I want to do today is to talk a little bit about what that means and the problems that it has caused, and baseball is one of our primary examples. We have intercollegiate baseball, and one person knew that last week because he happened to go to the college that was involved in it, which was Williams College against Amherst in 1859. So we're really into baseball very early, and we move quickly into commercialized baseball, and ever after we have that problem of commercialization versus education. And we begin then to wave a little bit on what kind of characters are we building, and is there a different definition for sportsmanship and for fair play, for example, in athletics than in play. And we look at play and we look at athletics and we begin to wonder, what have we done?
Can you open up the
rules? Oh, yes.
If you're losing the game,
change the rules. But in the baseball world, I have a serious thought about that, and it begins in 1939. And in 1939, I think television showed boxing for the first time, and it also showed baseball. You and I didn't see it, but something else happened in, I believe, Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and has affected your kids and my niece and nephew, particularly my nephew, ever after.
Little League.
And so the beginning of Little League, I think, is the beginning of the change in our society in which kids are to move out of play, even out of sport, into athletics. And what I call athletics is highly organized sport in which we begin to select out of the sporting experience, particularly early boys who did not fit Theodore Roosevelt's concept of what makes a man. And what makes a man is a kind of rite of passage vis-a-vis sport, meaning we make men by having boys play in very strenuous athletic kinds of contest. Now, he didn't really prefer baseball. What do you suppose Roosevelt would prefer?
Football.
And in fact, our first meeting to try to do something about 25 deaths in football was for Theodore Roosevelt, who is in love with both Yale and Harvard and the whole rah-rah concept of intercollegiate athletics. And he is afraid that we're going to lose intercollegiate athletics. And he believes that the Europeans are saying to us, you have a bunch of eggheads, pansies, and the very worst, starting with an S,
sissies.
And so we must have football. And we must have it vigorously, and we must have it seriously. And so Theodore Roosevelt not only wanted Little League, were he alive to do so, but he would want football to start with Pop Warner and maybe down to the T-ball age and certainly to the fourth grade of the Catholic leagues in terms of competitive kinds of programs.
Do you think it'll ever catch on? Or?
No, never. And so I think it's important to think about, as your kids are playing sports, that the concept started out not too bad. Muscular Christianity said that we will help make adults, and particularly men, but not the entire emphasis on men, but we will make them competitive, we will permit them to play, as it were, and we'll be teaching something in the meantime. And I think that's how sport and team sports started out. Certainly from 1880 to 1920, we had something called the playground movement, and the school systems began to put competitive kinds of sports in their programs in order to teach the immigrant kids to inculcate the American values in the young men. And so the fathers of the immigrant kids said, okay, if that's going to help make you a great American, then we will have sports. So we had all these kinds of good, wholesome reasons for starting our kinds of competition and the freedom to sport. But in the meantime, 1939 to 1989, we have these highly competitive kinds of programs for kids. As we look at that, what are some of the problems that come out of such a program?
Injury,
why?
Because their bones are still growing and everything, so they're putting stress on that they shouldn't put on.
Well, why don't they have the same kind of bone injury on the playground where they chose up teams and fought it out?
Contact sport. Kids will quit when they're playing with kids.
Great.
When adults want them to win, kids
will quit. One of the problems is kids will quit when they're playing with kids. Also, if an argument occurs, I take my toys and I go home. And if I am playing, I am learning a lot on the playground that I may not be doing. One of the big problems, and I guess I have it over here, is spectators. When kids are playing with kids, they have no spectators. When kids are playing with kids, they have no coaches. When kids are playing with kids, they have no umpire. They have no one putting additional kinds of stress on them. What kind of injuries are they getting in the little leagues? Any of you know?
Knees.
Knees, tennis elbows, since that's the sport I know. And the problem is that they are having those kids pitch. The rule says no more than 3 innings. But those 3 innings could last your 9 innings. And we still want the kid that's best to do that pitching. We have catchers that we put kids into becoming catchers in fourth grade, third grade, and from then on, the rest of their lives, they are catchers. Can you think of any position outside of all of the football positions that's worse for knees than catching? There simply isn't one. And girls are doing the same thing in softball now. The position is not the position for our knees. It's as bad as you and I exercising with the duck walk, which is down here, and doing all of these things, which are pulling on our inner ligaments and our outer ligaments. That's why in football they finally came to know clipping. Clipping is really rooting the knee as fast as you can. And 750 young men each year have knee injuries. And when your kid wants to play football, it's something that you need to think about. And there may be new sorts of ways of dealing with it, but there still are so many injuries. 50 deaths in this country in the last 2 years on high school and college football. And so we're turning play and sport into such an athletic event. And then with the young children, I think in the baseball particularly, that we have turned them into little adults in what we're expecting. So injury is a problem. Yeah,
I have a question with, you know, I can't understand why, you know, there is this, you know, sort of parents thinking they've got to be at every single game their kid ever plays from the, you know, 3 years old on. But because when I was growing up, you know, my parents showed up when I got to high school. But, you know, before that, we had our games and stuff, whether it was playground or even organized at school, and we showed up. And I'm just wondering, is there a balance, like you were saying, with the spectator, the parents that put some pressure on? I'm almost thinking maybe discourage the parents from showing up until the kids are old enough to handle that kind of spectator. Because now it's like the parents think it's their religion to show up for every game for the kid, or they're being sinful not to.
It's one of the parenting responsibilities.
Yeah, to show up every game.
The fact is, if I had my way, I would have parents outside the gate waiting for the kid if need be. And I would probably send the umpire with them. And for absolutely sure, guess who else I'd send with them?
The coaches.
And actually, let's take away the coaches first. Yeah. Then the parents, and then last the umpire, and keep 2 supervisors present. And put in all the money, it's still fine with me, for all of the kinds of money. And I want the coaches to coach them all week. All the boys and all of the girls.
You're talking about the fundamentals of playing the sport.
Right. And so, and we'll have lots of bats and lots of balls and lots of mitts that they all use them. And we just sort of rotate around. You don't have 9 kids in the field and the coach is fungo hitting. No hitting practice for the kids. No opportunity for each kid to handle the ball 50 times. So the problem is the very best time for kids to learn sport is 9 through 12. And what have we already done with them?
Make them little professionals.
Little professionals. And if you're a professional, you don't play two or three different positions. You specialize. Not only do you specialize in one sport, but within that sport, you specialize. So here we have the very best time for boys and girls to learn activities, and we let them go to Little League 5 days a week, 1 hour, and if they're good, fine. They're going to get lots of exposure and lots of experience, and if they're lucky, their parents aren't going to care whether they win or they lose. And their coach isn't going to care so much if they win or lose, if they're lucky, up until 12 at least. But the problem is, we have gone into the world, our capitalistic society says what to us? You've got to win. And that's where we began to change the muscular Christianity into a religion of the winning syndrome. What begins to be important, and it may be subtle, but it's important, is whether your kid, and even whether we are into domination and superiority or pursuit of excellence. And there's a world of difference between whether we're dealing with domination and superiority or we're dealing with pursuit of excellence and your own better self. So that in the process, we're leading towards your own better self, understanding and reaching your personal limits. I believe sport does bring self-confidence, self-image, better self-identification, cooperation, and particularly in play, a bonding that's very important for boys, also very important for girls. So I want girls to be equally experiencing all of the fundamental sporting activities that the boy is. And if I were the captain of the world of sport, I would take the concept of rite of passage vis-a-vis sport and the cult of true womanhood I talked about yesterday and throw them both out and see if we could then come to some kind of sporting experiences that's good for all kids and that they do learn about themselves, and as they get better and really like sport, that they ought to have an opportunity. I'm in favor of varsity sport for kids. But I'm even more in favor of intramural sports. And not that you have to give a shirt, but I want you to know I did win this in volleyball. faculty volleyball, thanks to Holden Village. In the years past, we had what I called volleyball, and we had volleyball. And I played here in pretty highly competitive kinds of games. But afterwards, there was a comradeship between those who played a lot throughout the summer here and a feeling of working together in oneness. And I think that's what intramurals. Intramurals, by the way, in case you don't have it in your institutions at all, is really extracurricular activity or clubs, they sometimes are calling them, in which the students who are not interested in playing varsity or are not willing to use that much time or aren't as good can play intramurals. The problem that has occurred in our high schools, of course, and certainly in our colleges, is that we began to put so much money into the varsity sports, which are few in number, and we also have therefore slowed down the number of sports. Yeah.
It seems like it's a, you know, kind of Reagan's trickle-down theory in a sense. I come from an area where we pay a 22-year-old $11 million to play football, and we pay social workers $20,000 to take care of our children for a year. And it seems to me that every time we buy a season ticket or plop our money to pay for watching this, we are a part of the system, because it seems as though our children are watching those games, and then they model that, and they want to be a part of that. And I'm just wondering if it just doesn't start from the top right down, and we're just a part of the system because we pay good money to go watch professional sports.
I would say from the beginning of the 20th century on that we have built a society based on the winning syndrome and based on the pro model. Now, I am into football, and I don't like being into football because I don't like liking football. But the fact is there's something about the competitiveness of football that I was denied in my own sort of growing up. And so I have taken on football. But there is only one way that we can stop this, as I see it, and that is by boycotting.
Well, I guess I'm not against, if they want to play paid professionals, but there's an incredible sickness about a society that will pay a man $1 million. Mm-hmm. And he's 22 years old, and we pay teachers and social workers to care for our children. I mean, it's insane.
No question.
What do you pay your babysitter?
Well, there is something really sick about it.
How else do we know in sport that our society is sick?
Do you boycott television?
Would I? I don't know, but I think that's
you're
the way.
You'll pay to go to a game, but you'll watch television.
That's right.
Isn't that true for most of us? We won't pay to go to see a baseball game, a football game.
Well, some of us will
TV.
Do that, too.
Some of us will.
But the only way would be the ratings would go lower and lower within the competitive world of sport in the pro ranks if we really would like to do something about professional sport. And professional sport is very serious for your children. And it's very serious for us in how we permit ourselves to look at sport and to know that those men that are out there playing football have used dope. Do you know of any professional football individual who hasn't used steroids? Do you personally know of any? Do you know of any? Personally have, in fact, I suppose. Do you know whether they do?
I would toss out that Steve Largent is fairly clean.
I would say we have 14 to 15% of our men that play professional football who have never used steroids. The value of steroids for the athlete is that it increases the possibility of developing your muscles. And it doesn't develop your muscles for you. But if you then train hard, you will in fact get stronger. And strength is what is needed in most of the sports. I teach this philosophy of sport class in which I had several football players. One, 2 years ago, selected to do his research paper on steroids. And in the process of discussing it, he talked about his own life and the life of his teammates at the University of Maryland. And he came out with an 85% of the men on the football team had used steroids. He came to college never having used steroids. And the first week he did fine. All the freshmen were there. The second week he said all of the upperclassmen came in and he simply was completely outmuscled, outmaneuvered, and there was a suggestion that he needed to be stronger. That suggestion said to him, you need to be stronger by steroids. Do they test for steroids? Sure, at our institution. There are certain time frames, however, in which you can lay off them. You still maintain your strength temporarily. And you have 3 weeks in which you can be tested. And you will test pure. But it's a commentary on our society. Do you think any high school young men use steroids?
Yes.
They definitely do. They sometimes do it by injections. So we have double trouble in the large cities. We have young male athletes who are not gay, who are not bleeders, who have definitely not had sexual intercourse with anybody with AIDS, but they have used needles for steroids that were reused. And we saw young athletes with not only steroid problem but AIDS. And that's a commentary on the importance of us thinking about What are we doing in relation to sport? And what are we looking at as our models? In building characters, I've got the saddest story, which certainly most of you men know, about the basketball player from the University of Maryland who had just signed a $2 million contract to play with the Boston Celtics. The day after he signed it, and after he had been declared clean by 8 other of our professional basketball teams, he died from an overdose of crack. And it has made our institution stand up and take notice, and we're trying to deal with the issues. But those trickle down even more. And so we need to, each of us, look sort of in our sporting world for what is it we're willing to let happen. And that it really is amateurism. None. A whole lot have started out. That is, the gymnast often started out paying for their own. The track and field athletes are a part of a school system. So many of them, swimmers, may have started out on their own, but we now have age group swimming. We now have age group all kinds of sporting events. And what we really have are paid athletes by virtue of escrow funds for our Olympians. The other day I gave a discussion, or we discussed a movie called What Price Glory? And it talks about all of the sacrifices of young men and women in order to be Olympians. And the story ends with one of the gals that is on the Olympic team is anorexic, has another eating disorder, and has an iron deficiency that they're not sure that she's even going to be in the Olympics. This is America. This isn't what the East Germans are doing, or what the West or the Russians are doing. This is what we're doing in America, and how important sport is. Now, I'm much in favor of competition, particularly if the child wants it, and the child is willing to put in some time and effort. But you're parents, and you have some responsibility in relation to how much time and energy kids are going to give in behalf of something like Olympic sports. Even how much time they're willing to give to varsity sports. Last week, a young man was talking about his best friend who played third goalie on the Canadian Olympic ice hockey team, and that he simply gave it up, that he could not stand the stress and the strain. And what is sport for? For all of us, it's for rest, relaxation, recreation, for making our bodies move, to having life and having it more abundantly. And what we tend to be doing instead is to having our own tensions and adding to sort of the tensions of children. As you think about it, are there any experiences that you think are things that the rest of us either need to know on the negative side, or some very positive experiences of how your programs are being run in relation to kids and children's programs in your part of the country? No good programs? Help.
Just a comment. I was pleased to see in the last year of our local high school's athletic program that they did remove from what was a potentially fairly good team 3 athletes that were caught drinking, that the school did not have any problem with the idea that the team wasn't going to win without them, and they didn't, but they were asked to leave the team because of drug alcohol violation.
And one of the values of that, is that we maybe aren't building characters then.
Yeah, Tom, you in the Little League team, the majors, went to the regional finals, so there's a high quality, but among the minor teams, which I coached, almost all the coaches had the attitude that play was more important than winning, and so I was impressed by that, because I expected the other coaches to be out to kill. And there was, you know, two of them that were kind of a little bit mixed up. They knew what they were supposed to, they just got caught up in them. But the rest of them really controlled themselves and did a good job. So I was impressed.
That's great.
In Houston, they have to have a certain grade average to stay in sports while they're in school. If they don't keep that average up, they're kicked off the team. So, and a lot of the mediocre students are starting to study a lot more, I think.
It's really hard to decide on that issue of using grades as a whipping post, in particularly for students that probably aren't good. On the other hand, we have found that even the black athletes under Proposition 48, which is that you must have a certain average, or you must have 750
on the
SAT. You have to have a certain score in the SATs, or you must have taken the academic credits and passed them with a C in order to play sports on the intercollegiate level as a freshman. Because it does not prevent them from playing sports at all, I don't mind Proposition 48 for our intercollegiate people. I'm a little concerned about grades, and I don't know what the answer is. I have an extended family of three children in which the parents have decided that I can send them to camp. The kids can do anything they want in the summer if I wish to pay for it. But the oldest boy had to have a 3-point. He was playing basketball, and he got a 2.9. They're not letting him, consequently, go to basketball camp this summer. So the boy loves basketball, and he's going to lose 2 weeks of intensive basketball, and he's not going to study in the summer. And so we had some philosophical discussions on that grade issue. And I don't know where I stand. For students that can do it, now, there's no question that Nicholas can do that. But at the end, he didn't. And I'm not sure that I want to cut it that thin for him. But on the other hand, he was capable of doing it and didn't.
What do you think of that summer requiring varsity players to play all summer?
I think it's terrible.
But it's happening in...
It's happening all over. The camps are more intense. If you had seen our basketball camps for boys from 7 to 12, you'd never let your son or daughter... This one was all boys. Go to it again. In the intensity, it was 100 degrees. I played tennis crazily for 45 minutes, and we stopped. Those 10-year-olds were out there playing basketball outside at 100 degrees, and they were dropping. And there was a coach standing there saying, "Are you sure you need a drink of water?" Well, we know now that all kids and all of us need drinks of water and that it's good for us. And here was an older coach saying, no water. So anything you need to have learned, it's that now water is good. Drink all the water you want, as much as you want, when you are in activity.
One of the problems in high school sports seems to be the difference between physical education and extracurricular and the sport you're talking about. And I know one of the struggles that a lot of school systems go through, especially when it comes to grades, is what are high school athletics? Are they an integral part of the school program, or are they extracurricular? It would seem to me that if they're classified as extracurricular, that's which my bias is, then grades are not a problem. I mean, then if a student is not, I mean, the purpose of going to school is to study and get grades, I would assume. And then if athletics then becomes extracurricular. In Europe, in an awful lot of foreign countries, they have all sorts of sports, but they're not connected with the school system.
They have moved into club variety.
Yeah.
One of the things that's hard for me to decide on, and having moved out of the high school scene, is that whole question of embodiment or dualism. Do we believe that the mind and body is separate, or do we believe that the mind, body, and spirit is embodied in one, and consequently that they happen to be called extracurricular, but are they not an extension of the school day? And that the whole question of grades then isn't answered for you, but the question of an educational experience, to me, is that it is an educational experience. They should be able to do intramurals, and they should be able to do after school. And some way or other, however, we have to look at their energies. And if we're taking all their energies, and that's what's happening on a lot of the high school levels, is young boys and young men, 16 to 18, are not fully grown. Young women are fully grown, but they too are being exploited and being asked to go beyond the normal potential of the athlete. Particularly, one comment while I'm thinking about female athletes, that we are so training our female athletes that we may be doing future harm to them in relation to those that have fat content less than someplace around 11%, therefore move into not having menstrual cycles. We're now learning that that will not affect them immediately, but osteoporosis, they're getting anemia, and more of those are moving into anorexia conditions. And so while we thought, and certainly I fought for Title IX, but we need now to reevaluate how much pressure we're putting on the young women. But we also need to look at the young men, because they are having growth problems, they're moving into steroids, and they too are more harmed from steroids than the football adult males are. And there's other kinds of uppers and dimers that high school men are taking, and that we need to be careful of that.
I'm concerned about how we as a society can differentiate between winning and the pursuit of excellence, because it seems like all of the things that are being mentioned that are bad for our children and young adults are in the pursuit of winning. And even if you get back to the comment about the young player who's paid $1 million a year, well, obviously that team is playing that player that amount because he's the best at something, and we want a team that wins, and the fans want to watch a team that wins. And it goes right down to us as parents, as you know, it sort of gets around that if you don't start your child in whatever it is by the time they're 7 or 8 and get them specialized in their position, then they're not going to be a superior athlete by the time they're however old. The same thing with the high schools, wanting the kids to play year-round. And it's because the focus, of course, is on winning, wanting the team to win. But it seems so hard to me, for us as a society, to get a hold of the idea that you don't have to win. I mean, that feels like such a fabric of America.
It is. But you as individual parents, and you can deal with your school systems more, it is not true that a child has to start at 7.
No, of course not. And those are
the truth is, if they learn a variety of sports from 9 through 12, that they can specialize as they wish and still be outstanding athletes. If they decide they want to be professional in something, then they may have to be even more serious at 12. But we can take a tennis player, for example, and make her an outstanding tennis player at 12 if she has come up the ranks in playing all kinds of sports and activities, and that she has, or he has, developed a variety of activities. But we wish them to have to start. Gymnastics, not true. We cannot start a girl at 12 and make her an Olympian in gymnastics. But in almost even swimming, they do not have to have given their lives to it. And except for the professional athlete, there seems little need to deal beyond the pursuit of excellence. But somehow that has to be an individualized. Just as we have to individualize boys who are not interested in sport because we've almost forced them not to be interested because by second grade they're behind. In some way now, co-ed may help that. The other problem that may occur, of course, is that girls are going to start to feel inferior and that they have to be great athletes in order to be great human beings. But we do have to work in our society. Our churches can also contribute by virtue of the kinds of activities that they sponsor for children. And your own attention to whether you're going to stay home from Holden for a week so your son can play in the finals of or in X kind of tournament.
We come from Kirkland, Washington, and we have emphasis on soccer. We have 12 soccer fields dedicated just to the students, the youngsters. They have a computer, everything. They just say what field this young man's going to play on and all that kind of business in advance, a month, 2 months in advance. And the fields are so groomed that a company came in and asked if they could cut the sod off when they were through in order to have to sell the sod. That's how far advanced they are in soccer.
However, soccer is a real good sport for kids. I mean, yeah.
In reality, soccer is better than baseball in the sense of you're not looked at it's for 5 minutes all by yourself, standing there naked before the world. And that's what we do now to little girls as well as little boys. And in that sense, soccer is a really good, vigorous kind of activity that we're dealing with, in a sense. One more that I want to go on to.
I was wishing someone would mention soccer because I have 3 sons that played soccer from third grade on up through high school. And then 2 of them weren't good enough to play in college, but they weren't a bit bothered about it because there was all the intramurals. And we don't have the role models in soccer. We don't have the $10 million a year people. And that's soccer has never really caught on.
Well, we're going to have the
World Cup.
The World Cup. And that's going to bring soccer, I think. Soccer is a good sport for girls as well. In fact, my hope would be that you expose your children to all kinds of sport, all kinds of activity, walking as an activity even for your children. Certainly hiking, cross-country skiing if you can, the tennis, all of the sports that are what I call lifetime sports. Bowling isn't much of a sport in the sense of physical activity, but it is at least in the group, and it is easily done in a co-ed setting. Bicycling. Bicycling has returned. My favorite t-shirt is bicycle because for you women, it also is one of the very best activities. And even in your fitness, move the stationary bike, if you're careful of the seat, is a wonderful activity. It also, by the way, for the rest of you, the bicycle was terribly important for women because of the dress reform, and the dress reform brought more activity, and activity brought other activity, and we moved into basketball and into more sporting kinds of events. One of the things that I want to be sure you get in relation to the sport for the children is that they do need to be physically active. They need to decide for themselves when to stop, and you let them stop. And for girls, that the best way to prevent osteoporosis, all of the kinds of arthritis that is suffered by women, and to help in childbirth is to let your girls play as vigorously as the boys, and that they are as highly skilled and can be as highly skilled as the boys, and that you continue to encourage that even in the junior high when they get to be just simply too tall and too different from the males. In competitive athletics, I'm very much in favor of separate boys and girls teams. In all of the physical education and all the rest of the activities, I'm very much in favor of having it all co-education. And I'm also in favor of helping the teachers to realize that potential so that each person can be reaching their potential. It will also help get rid of this concept of boys can only be men through sport. That is not the only road. And that girls do not become men by competing in sport, which will help, I think, maybe even a little on this play and removing us from that highly competitive idea. That it's a bonding that occurs that's so much better.
I just wanted to mention, my third grader has been going to a school. We live in south of Portland in a very rural area. And I was just really impressed because instead of just playing PE, they have an extension of the PE class in that the PE teacher offers to all the first, second, and third graders to be in this jump rope group. That, you know, it's boys and girls. They even put on a program at the end. Some of them were doing it on these pogo balls, even with pogo sticks while they were jump roping. It was incredible, the different tricks they could do with jump roping, but it was just excellent. They needed to learn the responsibility of being, they had to give up one short recess a day. It was you know, something they gave up that they wanted to do, and if they missed more than two or three, then they would drop down. But so they needed to carry through with it, but the competition wasn't there as far as the sport, and it was just excellent for them. You know, it was just, everybody thoroughly enjoyed it. They had a great time.
Don't you have a jump rope t-shirt?
No, I can't. I left my jump rope t-shirt at home. Which was jump rope for your heart.
Yes.
Or heart, yes. Jump rope.
But they had a jump-a-thon for right. Their heart. Yeah.
I don't have that one. Crushed. But what I'd like to do for the next couple minutes is talk about adult fitness and the importance of activity for those of you in the adult world. One of the things for women is to be more leery of jogging and of the vigorous kind of aerobics that you may have been doing. There's a book on the aerobics for women which does have jogging. But there's also a book in the bookstore about walking for both men and for women. And as I see the research that begins to be done, that walking, and I should have put my shirt on, is perhaps the very best exercise next to water aerobics that you can possibly take part in. And that 3 miles of walking a day, 3 days a week, can increase your cardiovascular efficiency or your endurance, and that's what you need for your heart, for your high blood pressure, to bring down your cholesterol. That walking can in fact do it for all of the advertisements for all kinds of other activities. Swimming can do it. The stationary bicycle is particularly good for all individuals who have any problems with their legs and the impact of jumping or of running. What we are finding for the female is that there are some bladder infections that are occurring for older individuals, which includes me, 55 and older, that you need to be sure that the seat is a good seat and perhaps even a softer one than you have if you're going to be very vigorous in this. Also, that you don't start exercising at 60 without having dealt with your doctor and with all of the potential problems that can occur in too vigorous. But it's also important for osteoporosis for women.
I was wondering about on the walking, about using the weights, okay, and stuff with that.
The newest thing is using weights, and it's good for both men and for women for this, so that it goes right within your rhythm. Start fairly light, and you can probably move to 3 men sometimes to 5 pounds, but that's a lot.
The heavy hand,
right,
is what I was thinking of.
That you're using. The other thing that you can do is simply to walk with your hands. We have to be careful of the joints on this one, I just learned, so you might want to do it lower. But as you walk, it helps the diaphragm, it helps the abdomen, that you're walking with your arms outstretched. People that can do but the next best, or even better, is to bend stiff at the elbow and arms up as high as you can and to walk. And then on the third mile, add that weight as you're moving, and that helps in all of the conditions that you need to get. You also want flexibility, but flexibility not beyond the normal range of your body. None of you need the splits anymore. And never, ever bounce anymore as you're doing flexibility exercises. That you go down once and back up. Also, on your sit-ups, you do not go beyond the straight line of your body. The other thing is that you need to begin to think about whether you really want to do stretching exercises before you move into vigorous activity. What we're finding is that the stretching exercises are doing more harm to the body than the running itself. That you need to warm up first. And so even a little bit of running in place or vigorous walking, then do your stretching exercises. And I know that all our lives we've done stretching exercises, but the potential damage is great. Also, if you're doing a set of exercises, be sure that you're not making one part of your body stretch beyond its normal range, such as that the horizontal position exercise in which you try to, I'm flat here, and I try to raise my legs. And what happens, you'll see, is that it pulls on my back. Never using both legs as leg raising in that flexibility. Then when you want strength as the third component of any kind of fitness program, how can you get it? What are the things that you can do to increase strength?
Weights.
You can put more weight on the body part. What else can you do?
More
repetition of it, more rapid. Do it rapidly. You know, lot more of them, faster, or weight in them. Strength stays the longest, it comes the slowest. And so you don't increase your numbers each day in any kind of exercise that you want to do, but you think in terms of the week. And the same with even increasing your walking, so that you start with your 20 minutes of slow walking, and you can move it up in terms of any kind of fitness program. The other thing that women particularly need to think about is to be careful of going on crash diets, which in fact then decrease your efficiency and your power to fight off disease. And because we're finding, even with middle-aged women, it's leading to anorexia conditions. And so men, too, need to be careful on your diets, that you ought not to be doing dieting. Men, much below 1,500 calories if you're doing calories. Women, not below 900 calories. And that means you're not in a vigorous job. So that over a week's time, you don't stay on any diet that claims less than 900 calories for women or about 1,500 for men. A few retired men might survive on 1,200. But you need to deal with your doctors in relation with your diet. But as a society, not only do we have the children's problems, but we ourselves are working ourselves to death, worrying ourselves to death, smoking ourselves to death, drinking ourselves to death, eating ourselves to death. And that exercise is not the cure-all, but exercise is the beginning of a kind of abundant living, and in that sense, then, it's going to help build your character, and that is all.